Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Evan Rapport, who is the author of Damaged, Musicality and Race in Early American Punk. Evan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm hoping you can start by telling us a bit about how this book came about, so how you got interested in writing about the sort of early American history and producing this book.
Well, a lot of things came together in the writing of this book. I've been very interested in, you know, punk as a fan for a very long time. Even going back to my elementary school days, I was in elementary school when Combat Rock came out and I loved that album. And this is something I've been thinking about for a long time and, but never really saw, I guess, the things I heard in punk and rock music in general really reflected in the books that I would read about punk. So it was like a book that I thought I wanted to read, but that didn't exist. And then when I was in graduate school, I took a couple of seminars that really changed my thinking about music in some interesting ways. I took a class on musical exchanges of African-Americans and Euro-Americans with Stephen Blum, who ended up being my dissertation advisor, and a class on American music scholarship with Eli Hassama, who is also a reader on my dissertation. And I started working on some of the stuff that actually ended up in the book in those seminars, thinking about race and how like musical style reflected the kinds of changes in racial formations that were going on in the 60s and 70s. And after I finished my first book, which was on a very different topic, but still an American music topic on immigrants, Jewish immigrants from Central Asia that live in Queens, I was looking for the next project. And I had published an article on the relationship of punk to the blues. And then it just seemed like this was a larger project that ended up being one of the chapters. And it just, the more I got into this topic, the more interesting it got, the more my mind changed about things I had thought in the past, the more I was learning. That's what I really love about doing research, doing scholarship. And I thought, you know, the book sort of like emerged in my mind as like a fully formed larger project. So that's kind of the way it went.
So before we really get into the text, and this is sort of in your intro, you talk about this, but I'm wondering if you can ground us in your understanding of where you see sort of punk, I don't want to say originating, right? But sort of how you sort of ground or the context you put punk into, like where it sort of comes from and derives from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the main goals of the book is to see punk in the sort of broadest possible terms and also as a dimension of American music more generally, you know, as a kind of rock music, as a kind of popular music, as a kind of American music. So seeing it not as this thing that's its own unique, you know, world that came from nowhere, but as something that was really, you know, of its time, that was a sort of maybe more intense manifestation of things that were going on, but still a part of what was going on. So, and I think there's so much, I guess this goes to what I was saying about how the book emerged. You know, I'm also a musician as well as a ethnomusicologist, a musicologist, and I played in a lot of rock bands, a lot of punk bands. Well, not a lot, but some. And, you know, the things I heard in the music, the relationship I had to it, the conversations I had with other musicians always seemed to have this kind of, you know, very open-ended, eclectic kind of, you know, point of view. There was always a lot of interest in stretching the music in interesting ways. Like, it was a very sort of music-centered kind of experience for me. And I always was finding connections with other styles of music. And, you know, the people I knew were very interested in music, broadly speaking, interested in history, interested in American music. I didn't see this kind of point of view that you sometimes see, oh, this music came from nowhere, it's ahistorical, people aren't interested in anything else. You know, we were always talking about, you know, jazz or classic rock or classical music or whatever it was. We weren't just like in this sort of self-isolated world. And I guess the other thing is to really situate it as a dimension of American music, meaning that so much of the early punk and the things that fed into punk were really coming from this American experience. And that's a hard story to tell, because the narrative of punk starting in the UK in the late 70s or mid to late 70s is such a strong narrative that it's that to draw a sort of continuous line between, say, the late 60s or the mid 60s to the late 70s and early 80s, that's focused on lived experience in the United States, it's a hard sell. So that was sort of the other thing I was trying to do when I was contextualizing the book, the music.
And one of the things that you talk at the beginning, but also throughout, is this, is thinking about location, right? Punk coming from sort of the suburbs and what that means, and whiteness. And so can you talk a little bit about that sort of thinking about whiteness in the ways, in the suburbs, in the ways in the 50s and the 60s, and what you saw happening historically?
Yeah. So there were so many things that, like I said, sort of changed my mind, changed my thinking about punk and the story I wanted to tell. One of those things was that the people who developed the punk style were almost all baby boomers that had this experience of growing up in the sort of like new suburban developments that are so famous in the post-war era, which were, of course, like, you know, now there's more scholarship being written on it, but it's something that we've always known for a long time, which is how severe the housing discrimination was in the development of those suburbs. So a lot of what I wanted to do was put these things together, I guess. They're not really new ideas. It's just a matter of sort of connecting the dots. Like, it's not a secret when these people were born. It's not a secret that, you know, Iggy Pop had a draft number. It's not a secret that, you know, the members of Devo were at Kent State during the Kent State massacre. It's not the whole suburban story is such a big part of punk. You know, there's a lot of talking about the suburbs, singing about the suburbs, complaining about the suburbs. But I found there was very little connecting the dots, you know, of like, well, how did people get to the suburbs? And then like, you know, what were they, if they were growing up in the late 50s and early 60s, like how did that music, and then let's say in the late 70s, they're playing that kind of music. How do those two things connect? So I'm very interested in this idea of whiteness as it relates to punk, I guess, in the most empirical kinds of ways. So I was really looking at not just do people think of themselves as white, you know, these identity types of questions, but really like, what were the lived experience of these musicians? Did they grow up in a segregated, you know, did they attend a school that was 98% white? You know, did they grow up in a suburb where their parents part of this movement? You know, how did their whiteness, if they were white, how did that shape who they are? How did that affect their experiences in school, you know, in their interactions with the police, in their wealth, you know, and the amount they had to sort of work and what kind of leisure time they had, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of, I don't know, it's maybe a long-winded answer to that question, but sort of looking at whiteness as a something that is directly impacting lives in a very, you know, measurable way often.
No, and I think that is really helpful for thinking about how you sort of structured the book and looking at the text as a whole, right? So you've put this into sort of two major parts, right? You have part one where you use punk as an adjective to sort of situate, and then part two where you talk about sort of punk as a noun, as the place to situate. And so in that first part, you sort of go into, you start with the blues. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. Sort of the punk is an adjective, and then let's move into thinking about the role of the blues in punk, right? In creating punk or thinking about punk.
Sure. So the first part, punk as an adjective, what I meant there is that it was really an approach to playing rock early on, and the people that we associate with punk, or the people that have been sort of placed in the punk genealogy, as sort of so-called proto-punks and musicians like that, that they are, you know, they were playing rock music, basically, that they weren't playing something that was a different kind of style. And looking at that, I mean, that's also in the sort of the usage of the word, you know, it's not like punk is this style, this clearly defined thing that we play. It's more like we're playing punk rock, a certain kind of rock. And that also allowed me to back the timeline way up, which is what I really wanted to do, which was to start like in the late 60s, which is where I really think, you know, you need to start with this genealogy. I mean, you could go back even further, but this is really where I thought it made sense for my story. And the people that I start with are really these mostly Midwestern musicians like the MC5, the Stooges, and you know, lots of other folks, but you know, those are some of the major players that were really coming out of a a rock world that was focused on certain kinds of blues resources. So another thing that's important in the book is thinking about the blues as a really vast musical world, not just, you know, 12-bar blues or that very specific kind of form, but a very wide range of of resources that musicians have put to use in different ways. And so what I look at are how these musicians who sort of so many, what I did was I looked at, you know, who did people that are sort of unequivocally, you know, punk or as close to that as you can get, who did they sort of look to and say, oh, this is where our stuff is coming from? You know, the Stooges are always invoked. So to me, the Stooges are like a very extreme version of a lot of the blues-based rock of the 60s, and especially this kind of rock that was focused on riff-based blues, blues that doesn't really go from chord to chord, blues that's very based on short cycles, like riffs that just repeat, 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 repeat. The Stooges were doing that to the nth degree. And, you know, a lot of other groups were as well. But I sort of look at the blues as like a, you know, to me, all rock music is a form of the blues. And so looking at the ways musicians approach blues resources is a very good way to sort of situate any kind of rock music. You know, where do they fall in this continuum from like, you know, this very riff-based blues, which you can hear in the music of, you know, Howlin' Wolf and John Lee Hooker and Robert Peat Williams and all of these musicians that were constantly being invoked by these white guys in the late 60s. And then on the other hand, you have blues resources that are very, say, like a lot of major closed form, 8-bar blueses, things like that, that we'll get into later in our discussion. But so that's what I was looking. And I look at, you know, other groups that were working with these kinds of blues resources in New York, Patti Smith, Velvet Underground, Suicide, in Boston, Early Modern Lovers, on the West Coast. Soon you have, you know, Flaming Groovies. There are like, you know, Captain Beefheart was doing a lot of this stuff. So there's, it's a sort of wide angle lens, but in the first chapter, I'm kind of looking at that extreme kind of version. And you know, it's again, it's not something that's really a secret. I just tried to put the dots together in interesting ways. You know, Iggy Pop is always talking about his interest in the blues, in James Brown, in Book of White, like all these different musicians. Some of it's a little bit more secretive, like with the Velvet Underground or with certain musicians like that, who kind of those connections got lost. But I was looking at, I guess the second piece of that is how did those, why were they doing it? Why, what did that do for their music? Why were they interested in that approach to the blues? And to me, that's sort of the one of the really, really key stories of punk is this use of these very, very intense blues resources, which were marked in the 60s very, very strongly, very heavily as black, as male, this kind of, in some ways, you know, very heavily stereotyped type of masculinity, black masculinity that was also exploited by a lot of the blues musicians themselves, people like Howlin' Wolf. And then there's this process, though, that happens in punk of a sort of step-by-step removal of those connections. And yet the resources are still there at the core. So that to me is what gives punk a lot of its tension and a lot of its power is this paradox between all of the music, all of the Black musical resources in particular that these musicians are drawing on. And then this narrative and this sort of obscuring of that history and changing and doing that musically, like changing some of the elements, like vocal style or things like that, that then kind of cloud the relationship. You know, we're not the Rolling Stones. We're not, you know, we're not just a bunch of white guys playing the blues, like that kind of thing. And then there's this sort of ending tension, this ending result that I think has kind of fueled punk from its very beginning.
And so you sort of start with that blues and also then thinking about the avant-garde and the role of the avant-garde in American punk. And you mentioned Captain Beefheart and others. So can you talk about then how you sort of saw, so that next chapter sort of moves into that, but how you saw that avant-garde playing an important role in this, in this early punk?
Yeah. So that was probably the hardest chapter for me to write in many ways. So looking at these musicians like Captain Beefheart, The Residents, Devo, Destroy All Monsters, a lot of these groups are invoked, especially like Captain Beefheart. You know, he's someone that's mentioned a lot as a precedent for punk or someone whose music played a big role, but very little explanation of what that means or any sort of tangible reality there. And I think, so that chapter does a couple things. First of all, what I was really trying to do is also look at this avant-garde and experimental rock, in particular, again, as thinking about this question always of like, well, why are the musicians doing this? What is the point? Why, you know, musicians don't just like do things automatically. No one's like forcing them to do that unless they're like in, you know, school band and, you know, someone is saying like, play this music. So they're making these choices for a reason, deliberately. And to me, it was that all these musicians, people like Beefheart, were what they were doing was sort of taking an experimental look at American music history. And they were, you know, using techniques like collage and parody and anonymity and masking techniques and all these kinds of things to offer a critique, offer an engagement with American music history in particular, and also even further, racial formations in American music, really looking at, for example, this narrative that rock and roll equals the blues plus country or something like that. So really looking at, these musicians were also working at a time where there was so much in the air about looking back at these, they're not really that much older, but looking at these commercial recordings of, say, the 20s, the 30s, the Anthology of American Folk Music, all of this sort of looking back and a lot of fetishization of these older materials. Again, my sort of goal is to look at these musicians as being of their time. And to me, someone like Beefheart is like, okay, you know, I see all these guys that are out there that are trying to be, you know, sort of in this musical past. And I'm interested in the musical past, but I'm also interested in how the musical past relates to our present and what I can do to offer a commentary there. I followed that as a sort of American story. So when you look at a group like Pere Ubu, and they're looking to Captain Beefheart, that there's a continuity that says, okay, these are all groups that are interested in the American musical past and how that's informed us and our tastes and who we are and our identities and those kinds of questions. So again, that's a really tricky one also, because a lot of those bands, like say a group like Devo, Devo forms in 1971, 1972, they're right in the wake of Kent State. You know, they're studying with Alan Kaprow and like these, you know, they're learning about experimental art, and they're forming in this particular world, this particular context. But then, you know, we only know them as this sort of 80s band, or that's kind of how we, how they live in our imagination. So it's a hard story to tell, to say like, okay, you know, this group that you know from Whip It, I'm really going to situate them 10 years earlier. And then if we're going to go 10 years earlier when they form, we also have to look at then their experiences that led them to that, or even earlier, et cetera. So a lot of those groups that I connected to the late 60s or the early 70s really became known, or sort of joined the punk scene in a way kind of late, or were kind of on the fringes for a long time. So that was kind of a difficult timeline story. And then also because there's so much that emerged in, say, the past 20, 30 years connecting punk to European avant-garde movements and groups like the Situationist International, that also, I think, kind of obscured that American connection. Not to say that the Situationists don't have American links and things like that. No. I think, did you ask me another question?
Oh, no, you keep going. You're good.
That's all.
Oh, no. I found this chapter really interesting, because I'm interested in sort of zines and the ephemera that comes from punk, but thinking about and situating it in relation to avant-garde, right, as music as opposed to text, and art creation or writing, was really interesting. So yes, I understand, and I found that really interesting.
Oh, thanks.
And you move from that into this thinking about like it being pure rock and roll, right, and the Ramones. And so in chapter 4, you really sort of ground us again back in this sort of like, and you, the title is Pure Rock and Roll with No Blues or Folk or Any of That Stuff in It, the quote from Johnny Ramone. And so can you talk a little bit about that chapter and what you're trying to do there as well?
Yeah, so, and this is also like to get into the weeds a little bit with these musical style questions. And I think that's something that my book, I hope, you know, offers that's different or somewhat original, is looking really at these musical features. One of the things that's been a little bit hard to communicate is that, and I think because I wrote this article on punk and the blues, and I start with the blues, and it's because the book is about race. And for a lot of people, that means, you know, blackness. They're not thinking about race and racial formations in, you know, in broad terms, and thinking about whiteness and these other, these other, you know, questions of binaries. And so there's a lot in punk that isn't blues per se, or that's a very different kind of blues than what I was talking about in the second chapter when we started our discussion. And to me, that's where you get groups like the Ramones. And there is a lot of conventional wisdom that what punk did was take the blues out of rock and roll, or to, you know, avoid the blues. But again, people aren't really being specific about what that means. I will say that for a group like the Ramones, so that quote from Johnny Ramone where he was saying, you know, we play pure rock and roll with no blues, no funk, no folk or any of that stuff in it. He's saying, you know, he's very explicitly saying, I'm trying to differentiate our music from the blues. And what he means at that time is not necessarily John Lee Hooker, but more like, you know, the Yardbirds or something like that, the Animals. Like, we're not a bunch of white guys playing the blues. That's something that runs through the whole book, is this anxiety of, you know, we don't want to be just another white rock band that's just playing, you know, boring, blues covers worse than the originals. And that comes from also a heightened stakes of playing the blues, heightened, you know, pressure to say, you know, a lot of black musicians, black writers are saying, you know, you can't stop appropriating, you know, the blues, stop appropriating black music for profit. So there is that anxiety, but people took different approaches to it. And what's interesting to me is, like, now people look back and say, yeah, Stooges, Ramon, Beefheart, like that's punk's genealogy. But at the time, like say the early mid 70s, you know, a group like the Stooges and a group like the Ramones were really, even though this has nothing to do with necessarily did they like each other, did they admire each other's music, but just saying stylistically, they were really going for two opposite kinds of effects. And then it was later punk musicians that were sort of putting these two streams together. So when I talk about that sort of Northeast scene, New York in the mid 70s, Boston in the mid 70s, a lot of what these bands were doing were looking back to the music of the early 60s. It's a very nostalgic kind of music, musically speaking. And again, this isn't like an invented connection. This is the actual childhood music or the teenager music of people like Debra Harry, you know, the Ramones. That's their musical memory. And that's why I pitch it also as a sort of nostalgia. It's like a literal looking back at, you know, the music, what was on the radio when we were kids, and also a looking back to that suburban world with some sense of loss, some sense of envy, some sense of, you know, wanting to recover that. So even though there's a bit of a, you know, again, that sort of punk attitude, if you look at a group like the Ramones, they're playing this music with very little irony. You know, Blondie, it's not ironic. Jonathan Richman, it's very much an embrace and an homage to that to that world of, you know, the Ronettes, Jackie DeShannon, Shangri-Las. You know, they are situating themselves in that kind of lineage, whereas, you know, that's very different from the Stooges sort of trying to put themselves in a kind of, you know, Booker White kind of lineage. So what I try to do is look at that stylistically and say, okay, you know, these forms are closed forms. They're AAB forms. They're using chord progressions like the Passo Mezzo Moderno, which had by that time become very much like a country kind of progression. You know, that's the progression that the Rolling Stones used for Honky Tonk Women. So I was looking at, you know, what's the different effect of playing that kind of music? You know, when Blondie does a cover of Denise, why are they doing that? Why are they looking to those resources when, Captain Beefheart, on the other hand, is doing, you know, Robert Pete Williams is, you know, Grown So Ugly, or, you know, very different kinds of covers and resources that they're drawing on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so after you've sort of grounded us in that progression to this point, you move into, because you sort of talked about that mid-70s, right? You move into that part two where you're looking at punk as more of a noun, right? Mm-hmm, it's recognized mm-hmm. as a term that is used to define this musical genre. And you start with the Atlantic coast and what's happening. So can you sort of talk about that transition into then this sort of first, I don't even want to say wave, but for lack of a better term for sure. now, of thinking about punk and grounding us in right. what has, yeah, we sort of think about punk.
Right. So the first part of the book, and even though it's in those three chapters and there's a chronological element to it, you know, it's important for me to, and what I tried to emphasize is that, you know, it's really the same generation of people. You know, Iggy Pop, Patti Smith, Johnny Ramone, they're all the same, you know, late 40s, born in the late 40s, maybe 50, 51 for some of them, that baby boomer generation. And it's just that a lot of the, say, CBGB music and stuff like that, they're making that generation when they're much older. So, you know, people like Deborah Harry is, you know, 30, 31 when they form Blondie. She had, you know, performed as a folk musician in a in a late 60s band. So she's been performing, she's been around doing these things. But so looking at it as this sort of one generation and their approach to these different musical resources at I guess different points in their lives. When you get to part two, you really start, I start looking at a later generation. Like now we're moving into this generation of people that are at the very, very beginnings of Generation X, or that sort of generation between the baby boomers and Generation X. And that starts with England and the United Kingdom, I guess more generally. So it's not that the United Kingdom doesn't play a role in this story. It plays a very, very strong role. It's just, I'm looking at how America looked to England and the UK as a, I guess, as an origin point, like how this narrative, American musicians, white American musicians get very invested in this, this relationship to the United Kingdom, that is the sort of origin of the music. And it goes back to the British invasion. So it's not that American musicians are ignorant of Black American music, or that they've completely forgotten people like Muddy Waters. That's not the case. But then they become very invested in this story that they've forgotten it. And that it takes, you know, Van Morrison or the Rolling Stones to reintroduce that to the United States. And this sort of British invasion relationship that repeats with punk. But these British musicians are also, they also have a freedom, I guess, in a way, towards these musical resources, and they start putting things together in new and interesting ways. And they are also sort of changing the music. So there's some truth to the fact that, you know, punk starts in, you say, England in 76, 77. Like, that's not a completely insane idea, but it needs to be contextualized. And for me, what that means is that groups like the Damned, groups like the Clash, they're working with these resources and putting them together in new ways. So, for example, looking at the Stooges and the Ramones and saying, oh, you know, we can combine this and do interesting things with those two groups that, as I had said, were kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum, musically speaking, in the United States. So I'm looking at that back and forth, especially among white musicians in the UK and white musicians in the US, and that, you know, why are they so invested in that narrative of, you know, the music needs to come from United Kingdom and then be reintroduced, and we need those people to show us our own music. Like, where does that narrative come from, and why are white Americans so invested in that story? So it's kind of like a two-pronged chapter looking at this story, this language of the British invasion and all that. And then also musically speaking, you know, how did a group like the Damned or the Clash put these elements together? And I will say that a lot of those musicians, most of the musicians that are forging this in the UK are also baby boomers. So it's also in the UK where you start to get this generational shift. You know, you got guys like Joe Strummer that are baby boomers that played in R&B bands that are musically transitioning into a new style. And then you have much younger people like, you know, Johnny Rotten, and you start to get the emergence of punk as a music by and for young people. One of the things that's really not, that's become confused, same thing with the, you know, the story of the beginning is 76 London, is that, you know, the CBGB scene, say like in the mid 70s or 1974, 73, it's not really music by or even for young people. It's quite an old group of people, musically speaking. And it's really not until you get groups like the Sex Pistols and in England that you start to get, okay, this is a music by and for teenagers, for example. There's very little of that before that. But just to sort of, again, couch that, it's not every group in England, not by a long shot. A lot of the, in fact, probably most of the musicians, even in that early London scene, are already in their mid-20s by the time they're making records, or even late 20s by the time they're making records and playing shows.
Right, and I thought that was something I wanted to talk to you about. So I'm glad you brought it up, because I thought that was a really interesting thing that you addressed, right, throughout the book. Is it, and you even have in the back a chart that sort of shows that the importance of really thinking about the age of the artists when they started, when they were performing, and you sort of make an argument, and this sort of moves us into the next chapter, that it isn't until we really start to think about California and what was happening in California, specifically Hollywood and that area, that we start to see young people really playing the music, mm-hmm, right? There's mm-hmm. a sort of shift, because the other thing you mentioned is that we... It takes a long time. At first, it takes a long time to go from playing the songs, right, or the band performing, to getting that music out and for people to hear that music. So can you talk about that, what was going on in California then that really sort of changed some of this and moved us into this this California punk scene.
Yeah, of course. So really simultaneous with what's going on in the UK, you have a very similar thing going on in California, in LA and San Francisco, where you start to get this generational shift. You start to get teenagers making music and putting out the music very quickly, right? So you get, rather than like I mentioned, someone like Debbie Harry, who's the music she's making as a young person is very different than the music she's making in 76, 77 as a, you know, as a someone in her early 30s. You start to get teenagers making music, you know, in mom and dad's basement, that kind of thing. It's something that we have earlier in the book, but I would say in the blues chapter, more like, okay, what's the music that Iggy Pop is making when he's a teenager, is this garage rock, early punk kind of music. So let's see, I'm losing the train of thought a little bit, sorry. But oh yeah, so in California, you start to get, there are these older musicians, you know, people like, you know, John Doe and Billy Zoom of X, Exene Cervenka of X. They're more of this earlier kind of punk as an adjective. We're playing, you know, fun rock and roll, Angry Samoans, you know, these bands. They're like older people that are playing, you know, aggressive rock, fun rock, you know, middle finger up at you rock, but it's still basically like, it's not like hardcore punk. It's not really like its own thing in the same way as you get later with groups, say for example, like a group like Bad Brains. So, but this is where it starts to emerge, and you start to get a really interesting, mix of people. So you have people like, you know, the guys from Red Cross, you know, Stephen McDonald, that, you know, 15, they're really, really young. And you have people like, you know, Billy Zoom, who's in his early 30s, and they're like playing the same kinds of venues, same kinds of shows. You know, the groups, the Descendants, the Adolescents, and a lot of times they're playing for each other. They know each other. They might be in the same bands together, like in Descendants, where you have Tony Lombardo, he's much older. And then you have the rest of the guys who are like in high school. And to me, that's really key to understanding also the shift in the music. Like, it's very different to be a group like the Ramones, who are singing about being teenagers and thinking about being teenagers, but they're in their late 20s when they're singing, you know, Teenage Lobotomy or whatever, versus an actual 15-year-old or a 16-year-old who's living at home and, you know, playing in the basement or something like that, and then making a 7-inch and releasing it. So it's different kind of music. It's a different kind of energy. It's a different kind of point of view. And also there's a different reference point. You know, those younger people are listening to the Sex Pistols. They are listening to, you know, the Damned, and their point of references are not just, you know, for a group like, say Patti Smith Band, you know, their reference points are, you know, Van Morrison, you know, the Beatles, Rolling Stones, those British invasion bands. You know, they're looking to, everyone loves Mitch Ryder. People are like Mitch Ryder crazy. You know, they're like looking to those. That's their musical point of reference, Shangri-Las. But a group like, Descendants or something like that, their reference point is, sure, some of those groups, but more it's, you know, the British punk bands and things like that. So you get this really interesting mix of musical styles and tensions over, you know, what is punk and what's the point of this and what are we doing? And to me, I think like any kind of paradox, any kind of tension it fuels punk as a style. Like it doesn't, it's not to be resolved. It's to be leaned into and to be like the more paradox, the more tension, the more contradiction, the better.
Right. And one of the things I thought was interesting too, is really you thinking about the role of segregation in LA, the LA suburbs, and also the makeup of the more diverse maybe, or the different crowd that you would see in LA than you were seeing in other places at the time.
Yeah. So again, just following the thread, like always looking at the connection of the music people are making with their lived experiences. And so, you know, by the late 70s, the suburbs are becoming a lot more, you know, ethnically and racially diverse. People are moving in. They're not being denied mortgages and stuff in the same ways that they were in, say, the 50s. You know, when Johnny Ramone is growing up in Long Island, places like Westbury, you know, it's extremely segregated. You know, there's, you know, in some of these districts, you know, there's, you know, five black people out of, you know, thousands. They're like, it's extremely, extremely segregated. That's not the case. In as we get later and later into the 70s, you start to get also looking at why that is. You know, courts are saying, no, you've got to address this. You know, civil rights, you know, the ACLU is winning lawsuits and courts are ordering, you know, busing. And there's like a lot of changes that are being that are just sort of happening because of, you know, the wider world that these musicians are living in. And I think that's also, you know, part of the challenge is if you're a teenager, you're experiencing these things, you're not necessarily analyzing it from this big picture and historical perspective. And even though the dots are there to connect, people don't necessarily, they're not able to connect them all the time, or they're not interested in connecting them, or they have some resistance to connecting them. So LA is still very, very segregated at that time, but it's more like they're, I guess, the students in these high schools, or the kids in these high schools, the people experiencing these shifts are sort of like, there's like battle going on about it. You know, there's people are fighting the busing. People are pulling their kids out of public school and sending them to private school. There's a lot of, you know, there's Proposition 13. And these are the things that these, you know, these kids are experiencing. They're experiencing Reagan. They're experiencing all this stuff. But their, you know, their experience of it is they don't have much control over it, you know? They have control over the music they're making and, you know, being in these bands and stuff like that. But it's sort of like they end up being at the center of a lot of these changes and controversies in new ways, I guess I'll put it that way. So when you have, say, like hardcore clubs or venues that are emerging in the suburbs, and these suburbs, in specific suburbs, you know, are being places like Redondo Beach or whatever, they're being that. That suburb had been kind of enforced as a segregated white, you know, particular kind of place. And the homeowners and the older generation are sort of working to maintain that as much as they can. There's a lot of racism. And then you have these, you know, these kids that are creating a very different kind of world. You know, they're out on the street, they're playing this crazy music, that, you know, and it's, there are these tensions that are emerging. But I was looking at, I really wanted to look at what was the reality, what was the empirical reality of this this phenomenon rather than just sort of like, oh, you know, we were out there and cops were bothering us and it didn't make any sense. I don't know why.
And we move from, of course, California, we have to go into DC, right? And hardcore. And so can you talk a bit about that, right? That seventh chapter before you really get to your sort of outro, the role of DC and mm-hmm. hardcore, mm-hmm. You know, Minor Threat, Bad Brains, those bands that we all know
right,
about
right.
that area.
So, part of the California chapter is also looking at the persistent whiteness of punk and the sort of growing discomfort that people have with that. You know, there's a sort of idea that punk should be a certain kind of thing. It's becoming more and more like that. It's becoming more and more that it's leftist, it's socially conscious, it's, you know, we're rebelling against, you know, mainstream, lame, you know, white suburban society. That's not really in there early on in the same way. You know, it's just not. And so you get that tension. But I think because of where punk comes from and how the stylistic choices that these musicians are making and the communities that they find themselves in, there's like a growing disconnect between what people want punk to be and what it is. And at the center of that is also this sort of racial homogeneity. Now in LA, there's this important element of the Latinx population and the East LA punk bands. And there's a lot of involvement by, you know, at the time, people who would identify as, you know, or use the term Chicano or Spanish or Hispanic musicians. And that's a really important thread that runs through. But there's still this persistent like lack of African-American participation. It's very, very minimal. And this, and also with the Latinx musicians, a lot of them are not having their situation is, they're not necessarily from East LA. You know, they're growing up in the suburbs, having the same kind of life as other, you know, as say like their white friends. You know, this is like the case with say a musician like Dez from Black Flag. Like he talks about growing up in Newark and he's like, yeah, but you know, I wasn't really related to that part of, you know, all the tension that was going on in Newark and like the racial tension. Like I wasn't a part of that. I didn't know about it. You know, his experience. And then when they moved to LA, his experience isn't particularly a racialized one. And that kind of racialization of him kind of comes later as people want to see these bands as being very multiracial or multi-ethnic, but it's a lot more complicated at the time. And a lot of what makes it complicated and a lot of what makes it malleable for people is that, again, there aren't Black people involved in any significant numbers. And when they are involved, it's extremely racialized, extremely tense. Like, you know, in zines you get, you know, people singled out and, you know, the N-word used in a sort of like fun way, mocking way. And like, it's very, very uncomfortable from today's standpoint, in my opinion. That's not the case in DC when you have Bad Brains at the center of this scene. Like all of a sudden, everything really changes because you have an all Black band at the center of a punk scene. They're not on the fringes. It's not one guy. It's not, you know, one guy who's heavily, you know, sort of like racialized and kind of teased in zines and things like that. They're really at the core of that DC scene. And that's a total paradigm shift. That's a total game changer. It's also a total game changer for who gets involved with punk, who feels like punk is for them. And as a mode of expression that's available to them. And I think it also has to do with that particular context of DC, where you have a majority, majority Black city. You have very, very desegregated or integrated suburbs. You know, places like Prince George's County, Howard County, where I grew up. It's a very different kind of world. It's a world where a group like Bad Brains makes a lot of sense. And so, but I think the fact that they are there, that they are this, and that's a big part of their story, their identity, you know, the things they say about themselves in their writings and in their music is that they're this all Black band in an all white scene. And so all of a sudden punk has to kind of reckon with this situation and this, this kind of racial reality, that this uncomfortable racial reality, in a way that they, that people involved in the scene never really had to do up until this point.
Right. And you sort of see this happening and you see this going on, and you sort of end with this idea that we have all this, right? We've extended and come into the 80s, but you want to look at some of the ways in which there's more contemporary settings or contemporary examples of what you have seen going mm-hmm. on throughout the book. So can you talk a little bit about some of those more contemporary examples that you see?
Yeah. So, I mean, because the book is so, it's really based in a very, at this point, you know, we're talking like half a century ago. even though the music sounds very contemporary, it's not. But one of the conceits of the book is that we're still wrestling with these racial formations, with these paradoxes, with these tensions, with these formations of Blackness and whiteness that were sort of forged in the 60s and 70s. And I believe that. And I think that's why I hope, you know, the book is relevant for today. And you look at a style like punk, and what I was really trying to show is what is the legacy of all of this stuff that I just, you know, outlined for everyone. You know, the book ends really in 1981, you know, Minor Threat. And, you know, we're a long way from that. So I looked at, you know, the blues, you know, how these blues resources, or what I called the raw power style, you know, how that persisted in, you know, in groups like, you know, Hairy Pussy and Bikini Kill and this, you know, a lot of the sort of Black punk bands, and why that style sort of continued to be used. I looked at, say, the questions of narrative, you know, how a group like Death figures into this history, you know, an all Black punk band or a rock band that's been sort of rediscovered, or that was rediscovered maybe 15 years ago, and is sort of put in this place of being a proto-punk band or a predecessor of the punk style, or even like an inventor of the punk style, when, you know, in fact, they never played out. They never, you know, their record was never really released except for a 7-inch that they put out privately that was never really even heard by anyone until it surfaced much later on a very obscure compilation. So why a group like that has been put into that kind of role historically. And I looked at, you know, the growth of books like mine and college courses and this sort of, again, that historical nostalgic impulse in punk. You know, it's interesting, like there's so much myth making about punk, and it's so different from the reality. So like there's this question of ephemera, you know, you mentioned ephemera, like flyers and you know, these things that are supposed to exist for a short amount of time, but there's so much saving of these items and then archiving them, and now like there are these archival collections all over the country at very prestigious college libraries. So there's always been that historicizing impulse. There's always been, you know, a lot of taping of shows. There's this sort of like awareness that what's going on is important or potentially important. So I look at, these sort of tensions and how like that's I think an interesting contemporary phenomenon, that there's like, now we know that punk is like a thoroughly historically oriented music. And I think that's sort of borne out by, say, like all of this archiving, all of this collecting, all of these coffee table books, books like mine, things like that. So I'm trying to think if I left out anything else in the last chapter, but I'm just sort of looking at trying to make a connection to today. And I think, I hope that when people read the book, their ears will be kind of retuned and they'll start to hear these things when they listen to music, when they're assessing music, analyzing it, and also when they see certain phenomenon, when they experience them, like looking at, this story about racial segregation and housing discrimination, and like, I'm making these connections to, say, these early rock bands or these early punk bands. That's what I hope.
So we've been talking a while, so I'll ask you my one last final question. Okay. If there's anything that you're working on now or anything else that is going on with this book that you sort of want to, one last final, anything you want to promote?
No, I'm just sort of working on promoting this. So I really greatly appreciate you, taking the time. I'm very interested in, I guess, I want to see how this book, I'm really interested in how this book is read by people outside of academia. So that's kind of what I'm interested in. And I also think it's an interesting thing about this show and the New Books Network, and just sort of like looking at how, getting this sort of, I wanted to make it something that people outside of academia would be interested in and would read. And there's been a lot of positive feedback right now. And that's what I'm hoping for. It's really interesting because when I started doing the, presenting the research that I was doing, say on like punk and the blues, say maybe 10 years ago, the response I got was very, very different, both inside and outside of academia. So I got a lot of kind of knee-jerk reactions, negative reactions. Well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And now I think, the world is different. People are just more attuned to these kinds of things. They're more self-reflective about these kinds of things. White people, basically, I'm talking about. And the response has been good. So that's kind of interesting. I want to see what happens there. Hopefully I'll continue to get people talking.
Well, it's been really great talking with you again. This is Evan Rapport, who is the author of Damaged Musicality and Race in Early American Punk. Evan, thanks for talking with me on New Books Network.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. Thank you.